commandments, those we do have to follow. Okay, so that's one framework. Because God never changes, so the moral laws live on. I think that one's fine, that framework. It's not evil. But I don't particularly find it that helpful. The reason is because none of the New Testament authors employ this framework. None of them say there's different kinds of laws. Moses himself, or whoever's writing in the Torah, never says, here's these different categories of laws. It's a framework that has come upon the text after it. Again, that's not evil, but it's only so helpful. The other one that often gets used is simply this. If the New Testament writers restate the law, it still applies. If they don't, it doesn't. And that's okay too, except that there's certain things that don't ever get restated that we would still say that's a pretty good law we should follow. Scanning for children. You know, like the bestiality laws. That never gets mentioned again in the New Testament. But probably good still to follow it. But the problem I have with these two frameworks is that we lose the deep wisdom of the Old Testament if we try to chop it up in ways that the New Testament authors never said to chop it up. So instead of saying this part applies, this part doesn't apply, I think the more faithful way is to say that all of it applies and none of it applies. Or maybe to say that all of it applies, just not how you think. The law is like a package. It's a package deal. And as 21st century Christians, you aren't bound to any of it. Paul says in Galatians 5, at the beginning of the chapter, he says this, "For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." Listen, I, Paul, am telling you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, a major part of the law, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Once again, I testify to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obliged to obey the entire law. It's a package deal. There aren't some categories that apply and some that don't. The New Testament authors treat the law as a united covenant. They call it the Old Covenant. So my take on the law is this. We're no longer bound to it, but it would be foolish to ignore the deep wisdom within it. We're no longer bound to it, but it would be foolish to ignore the deep wisdom within it. The law of Moses was given to a particular people, living in a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular covenant with God. It was given to an Iron Age agrarian community in the ancient Near East. It was not given to you or I. Yet, early on, in Jesus' most famous teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, he says this in Matthew 5, verse 17. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." He says, do not think I have come to abolish the law, the Torah, and the prophets, but to fulfill them. Jesus says he's not erasing or destroying the teachings and instructions in the Torah. And he's not erasing the prophet's interpretation of that. But rather, he has come to fill up this teaching, to complete it, to flesh it out and interpret it properly, to fulfill it. He hasn't come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. By ignoring any of the law, we're forfeiting deep divine wisdom for how to live as a community of God. As I was reading about how to preach on this week, it was overwhelming because there's all this sort of stuff. I read almost a whole book that's just about the difference between how law functioned in the ancient Near East to how modern law in the West functions. And it's just, the analogy he used is like, yes, football is a sport, and curling is a sport. And so, yes, they're both law, modern law today, you know, with statutes and case law and all that. And ancient Near Eastern law would be like curling, you know. It's not similar in almost any sort of a way. And law itself is not the greatest translation. When they're talking about this sort of stuff, they're talking about Torah. Lowercase T, Torah, means teaching, instruction, guidance for how to live. Capital T, Torah, they're referring to the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures. So there's a lot that is very different. But by ignoring any of it, again, we ignore deep wisdom on how to live as a community of God. However, I'm not saying that the law of Moses applies on a one-to-one scale today. Right? People who would say that the law of Moses still applies today are called theonomists. Nomos meaning law, theo, God. They're people who say the law of God should still be followed exactly as it was today. So we should become a theocratic society that instills these laws and rules into our guiding documents and punish people accordingly. Okay, so I don't think it correlates like that, one-to-one. But I do want to mention a few interpretive principles that can be really helpful when thinking through the law and how it applies today. Mission, intention, and love. The first, mission, interpret the law of Israel through the mission of God for Israel. And so with this, we're starting with really big picture stuff. Interpret the law of Israel through the mission of God for Israel. In other words, why did God give the law in the first place? What was God's point with Israel, with creating this people? What's the purpose? What's the telos, the end goal? And in Genesis 12, we hear God telling Abraham why this all is happening. And it's essentially to show what God is like and bless the whole world through this particular people. And so the law was to guide them to become the kind of society, the kind of community, the kind of people that would display the goodness, truth, and beauty of God. Israel was to live a certain way so that others beyond them would be blessed. And so one of the reasons that the Christian tradition has preserved these writings is so we understand the narrative that Jesus is stepping into. if Jesus is fulfilling anything about Israel, we need to understand what the point of Israel was in the first place. The Old Testament law wasn't given to the whole world. It was given to a specific group of people in a specific time. We have it today to show us what their life was like under God's teaching and how it affected every aspect of their lives, individually and corporately. There was a reason behind the teaching and instruction. Israel was to be distinct, set apart from the other nations. But we always have to remember why. The point of Israel being distinct and set apart wasn't so Israel could be distinct and set apart. Right? That's not the end goal. They were supposed to be distinct and set apart so that they could actually be a blessing to the rest of the world. The way Old Testament law functions, like I said, is very different from modern day law. Israel didn't have like a reference book with different laws to apply in different situations that had a topical index that they could look up. Okay, this thing happened. Let me flip through. This says laws about this category. What Israel had was a story. They had a story about who they were. And within that, there were guidance, commands, instructions. There was law within that, but it wasn't like, oh, here's just a list of laws. We either follow it or don't. Law was always part of understanding who they were as people. Let's go back to cheeseburgers for a moment because I'm hungry again. But remember, dairy and meat can't be mixed in kosher food. And this is an interesting one to me because if you were to scan the scriptures and look for a law that says dairy and meat can't be mixed, you wouldn't find one. You wouldn't find one. But what you'd find is this one law that gets repeated three different times in three different places. You know what it is? It's this law that says, do not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. Do not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. And this can be really confusing if you use, the other phrase for what a baby goat is, a kid. Because you read it, it says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. And you're like, well, yeah, of course not. But it means baby goat. Anyways, why? Why not? Have you ever had certain meat poached in milk? You know, like a chicken breast poached? It's quite delicious. But we say, why not? And that's a question that the rabbis were asking as well. It seems obscure, yet it gets mentioned three times. Don't boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. Some rabbis said this is a particular kind of law. And I forget what the Hebrew word is for it, but there's a particular kind of law that intentionally is obscure and mysterious, and the point of it is that you follow it even though it doesn't make sense. The point of it is you show your submission to God by saying, even though this makes no sense at all, I'm still going to follow it. So some think that's why this law exists. We're going to follow it. God knows more than we do, and we're not going to do it. Other rabbis were not satisfied with that answer, and what they came up with is that God doesn't want something dead being cooked in its very source of life. They're saying to do something like that would be inhumane. It would be cruel. The source that gives life, in this case, the mother's milk, shouldn't be used to cook that which has lost its life. In this case, the baby goat. They're saying there's something off about that. Something cruel. Something unholy. Something that doesn't seem to be in alignment with the character of God. And for us, I mean, we live in a day and age where we're so distant from how our food comes to us. How it's made, the process that happens. I'm signed up for this thing called Butcher Box, where literally I get shipped to me a box of frozen meat that's already packaged. It just shows up on my doorstep. I don't have to reckon with how that meat got there. But living in an Iron Age agrarian society, that would not have been the case. You wouldn't just have a gallon of milk in your fridge and decide, I'm going to poach a goat leg in this. You would have a slaughtered goat, and you would have to make the intentional decision to then go put your hands on a mother goat and milk that goat to get the milk. Almost staring at that mother goat in the eyes as you're taking the source of life for her children and using it to cook one of her dead children. That feels pretty cruel. So that's the reason why the kosher law exists, not to mix dairy with meat. They're saying dairy is always meant to be the source of life, right? It's always coming from some mammals' milk that's meant to feed and nourish. And meat is always something dead. And it's really important in a lot of Jewish customs. You don't mix life and death. It needs to be clear that which gives life is different from that which has experienced death. But then there's a whole other layer to it. This is pretty cool. In 1928, there was a Syrian farmer who was digging and hit something heavy with their shovel. And so eventually some French archaeologists come out and they dig and they find an ancient city called Ugarit, an ancient Canaanite city. And within that city, the coolest thing they find, I think, they find like some temples and stuff, but they found a giant library, And in the library, they found some books that were for the Canaanite priests that described different religious rituals that they would do in Ugarit. And in one of their ceremonies, particularly a ceremony for fertility, it says to boil a baby goat in its mother's milk and then sprinkle that milk on whatever it is you're hoping will grow, either on land or on a woman that you're hoping will be fertile. And that's what they do. I mean, whether they actually did it or not, I don't know, but that's what it said in their book. And Israel, remember, the purpose of Israel is meant to be an alternative society that models another way of living. They're meant to be different. If the Canaanites are boiling baby goats in their mother's milk, the Israelites will not be doing that. God is saying to his people, you will not participate in this cruelty. You will not mix death with life, even though your neighbors are doing it. Even if your neighbors are doing it and it seems to be effective. If they've got double the crops growing than you've got, right? If their women are having more children, you are not to do this. If you're worried about fertility and harvest, you will come directly to me, God says, and I will provide for you. And I share this one because it seems like one of the most obscure of them all. But even within this seemingly obscure law, there's a moral logic behind it that's meant to differentiate Israel as humane, as caring for her animals, and as substantially different from the Canaanite people. So when you're reading Old Testament law, ask yourself, how does this interact with the mission of God for the Israelites, the mission of God to create a distinct people who will bless the world? Drew Johnson, this is one of the books I read some of, a guy named Drew Johnson, his name's spelled D-R-U, that kind of Drew, he says this, within the biblical laws, One prominent goal is for Israel to become a community that breathes and produces justice and righteousness for the sake of all the families of the earth. It's Genesis 12:3 talks about that. And then he mentions these stories. He says, where Sodom's community-wide violence had become normal in some places, Israel's justice would be the antidote. And then he says, this is what makes the episode with the Benjamites reenacting Sodom so darn depressing. So you can read Genesis 19 about Sodom, and then you can read Judges 19 about the Benjamites, an Israelite tribe, essentially doing the same thing. So Israel's meant to be this distinct community, but over and over again, they fail to do so. He says, where the exploitative practices of idol worship had trapped folks in poverty, sex slavery, and worse, Israel's righteousness was meant to buffet any such practices within her porous boundaries. This is what makes the whole book of Kings so darn depressing. So he's saying they're always meant to be this alternative society, which that means when you actually read these stories and you see that they're not most of the time, your heart is meant to sink. It's not just, oh, I guess that's just human nature. This is a particular people that's meant to be different. And over again, they're not. So to understand the purpose of some of these laws, we have to understand the mission of God. Why is God making Israel in the first place? The second question we ask is about the intention of the specific law. So when you're interpreting a law, try to understand its intent and the wisdom within its historical context. So sometimes we read these old laws and they sound insane. They sound unjust. But when we understand the way society was functioning, we can begin to pick up on the kernel of justice there. How it was meant to care for the vulnerable person within that society. If you were to list out the laws, right? Some say there's 613 of these different commandments. But if you were to do that, just take them out of their story, take them out of their context, make some list, and decide, I'm going to follow these. I'm going to follow every single one. AJ, I think Jacobs was his name, tried to do this, The Year of Living Biblically. It's a pretty wild book. But not only would you not be able to do it because some of them are just culturally impossible today, you wouldn't also be able to do it because some of them contradict each other. The reason is it's not written to be a list that you follow. Some of them develop on each other. Sometimes the people are understanding God more deeply and realizing, oh, the intent of this law, in order to fulfill it now, we have to do something a little bit differently. So like one example is sometimes it says, you know, don't ever marry your sister-in-law. And then other times it says, if your brother dies, you must marry your sister-in-law. It's called Levirate marriage. And the idea behind it was to provide offspring, right? So if my brother died, I would be obligated to marry and try to impregnate my sister-in-law so that someone from our family line could hopefully be born honoring his name, honoring my brother's name, as well as taking in my brother's wife into my home because a woman wouldn't have had the means to provide for herself and for her family in that day and age. So the idea behind it was around who is the vulnerable party here and how do we care for this person and honor this dead man's legacy. There's also rules around slavery. Sometimes it says, you know, after this long, this person has to go free. Other times it says, no, they never get to go free. Other times, you know, about the same person, and it's in different books, and you have to read and look and see what's going on here, and is something developing? Is there a level of justice that's developing as the context changes? A really cool story is in Numbers 27, the beginning of the chapter. And this is right before the people are to inherit the promised land, right before they're to have the promised land. In Numbers 26, they do a census and they figure out all the men and they say, okay, these men from these different tribes will get these different portions of land, right? So they want to make sure every male over a certain age inherits some land. And at the beginning of Numbers 27, these five women show up to Moses, and they stand before Moses and the whole council, and they say, our dad died, and he never had a son. We're his only descendants. We should get some land. That wasn't what the law was. Moses says, you've kind of got a point. Let me go talk to God. So he goes and prays and talks to God. And they end up, when you follow the story much later in Joshua, they eventually get land. It's pretty amazing. Because of these young women's courage and insight into justice, and because they understood God's law wasn't so much about a law. It was about the intent behind the law, about justice and fairness in distribution of the land, they could go and advocate for themselves. Okay. One of the overarching themes we see in these laws is that they prioritize the weak and the vulnerable, and that the law is an attempt to create a just society that limits harm. If we had a lot of time, I'd go through some of these really obscure ones and show how is this prioritizing the vulnerable. I won't talk about one. There's a really interesting law, though, where it says if two men are wrestling or fighting and the wives of one of them goes in and grabs the other guy's testicles, you need to chop off her hand. Anyways, another time. Maybe next year if we do this questions welcome, you can say what in God's name is going on there. But we don't have time to talk about it today. But it does prioritize the vulnerable, believe it or not. Okay. And so when we're looking at the laws, we need to ask, what is the overarching intent of this law? And are there alternative, better ways to fulfill that intent more fully today? Notice that language, fulfill that intent more fully. When the laws serve their purpose to protect the weak and the vulnerable, they are gifts to the world. They are gifts to the world. I think about the different ways we think about law today. Again, big chasm between the way ancient Near Eastern laws functioned and the way laws function today. But I think about how different communities think about the law. Like if you were just to say law, what do you think about? There are some communities who have only been on the negative end of the law. And so for them, the law is something that oppresses. It tries to keep the poor poor and the rich rich, tries to maintain the status quo. It's painful, it's oppressive, it's not a good thing. For others, the law is just a killjoy, right? Like maybe if you're a teenager or a college student and there's a curfew, the only purpose of that is to suck fun out of life. Laws are no good. Right, it's just a party killer. For others, the law is just something that you need to skirt around. Right, like it's kind of an inconvenience to my company that they want me to follow these environmental policies, but with a good enough lawyer and enough politicking, we can probably avoid it. Right. So the law is an inconvenience, but ultimately, it's not going to stop me. And then for others, the law is a safety net. The law you've seen maintain order. Within chaos, you've seen protect you, and you're really grateful for the law. In ancient Israel, when the law served its purpose, when it actually protected the weak and the vulnerable, it was to be seen as a gift to the whole world. Look how law can function in a society. This is why the psalmists, they say, "We love your law. It is amazing. Like it enlivens our hearts. We want the world to see what a just society can look like." Okay, so that's the second. Interpret the intent within its historical context. And then the last one is interpret the law through the lens of Jesus. Through the lens of Jesus. In Romans 10:4, Paul says, "Christ is the goal of the law, which leads to righteousness for all who have faith in God." When we interpret the law through the revelation of Jesus the Christ, we're more likely to be oriented towards its deeper goal. Righteousness, right relationships with God, with one another, with ourselves, with all of creation. As Jesus interprets the Torah, we see the way he prioritizes the vulnerable and sums up the law through the interpretive lens of love. Jesus prioritizes human need, and in his teaching on the law, he's trying to show that that was always the point. There's a story in Matthew 12. We can read some of it. It says, "At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.' He said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? How he entered the house of God, and they ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for him or his companions to eat, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and yet are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means," and he quotes their scriptures, "'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." Jesus is showing how the law can be used to condemn those who aren't even guilty of it. But he's also showing that there's a deeper theme running through this. He's saying there's something more good and beautiful here. He's saying the point of the Sabbath, one of the Ten Commandments, right, one of the big ten, it's an important law, is not for us to offer God some sacrifice. He quotes the prophet saying, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." The point's not to offer God some sacrifice. Fine, God, I won't work for a whole day. I'll forfeit the income I could have got. I'll make this sacrifice for you. The point is for us to be formed into a people of mercy. God wants his people to be merciful. And to truly follow the law, then, is to realize that God's heart is for people. So human need must be prioritized. Jesus, over and over again, talks about how it's not just flat. We don't just read the Old Testament flat. He says in Matthew, I think it's 23:23, how there are certain priorities. Jesus is saying it was actually good that David and his men ate the bread that was only for the priests. This was good that they did it, not bad. They were hungry and they needed food. He's saying it was good that his disciples were picking grain. They were hungry and they needed food. He's not saying the Sabbath doesn't matter. He doesn't say, forget about the Sabbath. That's stupid. That's for people who were, they didn't understand. He's not destroying it. He's not abolishing it. He's filling it in. He's showing the deeper and truer purpose of it. Luke 10, 25 through 28, it says, a legal expert stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he said, what must I do to gain eternal life? Jesus replied, what is written in the law? How do you interpret it? Remember we talked about asking questions and how Jesus' answer to a question is usually a question, especially when they're trying to trick him. What do you think? And he said, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said, you've answered correctly. Do this and you will live. And the story continues on, but he says, this is the right answer. Do this and you will live. This is what is written in the law. These are the kind of questions that Jesus gets asked over and over again. What is the intent and purpose behind the law? And so this is the work that Jesus does. He reinterprets the law in a way that doesn't contradict or eradicate it, but fulfills it more profoundly. He sums up the law into love of God and love of neighbor. Remember earlier we heard from Paul in Galatians 5 where he said, for freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Listen, I, Paul, am telling you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Once again, I testify to every man who lets himself be circumcised, he is obliged to obey the entire law. And it sounds like it's mostly just saying, you've been set free, so be free. And it is, but then just a little bit later in the chapter, that was Galatians 5, 1 through 3. Picking up in verse 13, Paul says, you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only, don't let this freedom be an opportunity to indulge your selfish impulses, but serve each other through love. And then he says, all the law has been fulfilled in a single statement. Love your neighbor as yourselves. This becomes the interpretive key for the whole darn thing. So you need to understand the mission of what God's doing with a people group in the first place. You need to understand the intention of each one within its historical context. And you need to use the interpretive key of love. If it doesn't lead to love, you're reading it wrong. We are not bound to any of the law, but we are bound to the law of love, which, by the way, will often look like much of the Old Testament law. Because the God of the Old Testament, despite what you may have heard, was not a God of anger, not a God opposed to love, but a God of love. And we see that God more clearly in Jesus. Oftentimes, the law of love will look like the Old Testament law. Other times it will look like a fresh application of that law because we need to bring the intent and purpose into our modern world. What we follow today to answer the question, what of the Old Testament law do we have to follow? The law of love. Not mushy love, but self-giving, other-centered love. Love that Jesus epitomizes on the cross when he says, no one has greater love than to give up one's life for one's friends. I think someone was maybe checking with Siri if that's true or not. We come to the table every week. And at the table, Jesus is saying, this is what love looks like. He says, love looks like a life broken open and given away for others. Jesus says, love looks like a life poured out for the sake of others. And it's at this table that Jesus says to his friends, I give you a new commandment, a new law, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And so together we proclaim, great is the mystery of faith. Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again.